You are Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, welcome into a Monday edition of Locked On Heat, your daily Miami Heat podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the only podcast that breaks down every Heat game, news item, rumor, and more. Thanks for listening on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or on the brand new podcast app, Himalaya. My name is Wes Goldberg, and I'm here with David Ramil. We're debuting a new Monday show. We're calling it Blue Notebook Monday, where for the next few months, until the NBA draft, David and I are going to scout one draft prospect every week and talk about how that player might be a fit for the Heat, or maybe not. The idea is to discuss these prospects much in the same way that NBA front offices do, going through strengths, weaknesses, player comparisons, and more importantly, how we see that player's career panning out. We're each going to scout a different player and bring our findings to the table every week. And we're going to start with your player, David. Who did you spend the last week scouting?
Well, I'm following Pat Riley's lead. I'm taking my blue notebooks. I took a couple days off, but I've got my dozens of blue notebooks. I'm just writing down thoughts constantly as I'm looking forward to this offseason and how to get this team better and how to take it to another level. And so I scouted Cam Reddish out of Duke as my first blue notebook Monday prospect.
Do you really have a blue notebook? Because I wrote down stuff. I've got a yellow, what's it called? A legal pad, yes. Whatever those things are called.
Yes.
The yellow pages. That's what I'm working on. What are you working on?
It's actually a reporter's notebook.
Okay, so you're using your reporter's notebook. Yes. Okay, so no blue notebooks actually, but we're going to call this blue notebook Monday.
It's like a hint of blue on the cover. Maybe you could kind of stretch a little bit. So
I'm not even using blue ink.
Oh, wow.
I should probably at least use blue ink, huh?
We're ruining this segment. We've come up with this whole idea so we can, you know, the draft isn't something that we take immense pride in, or at least I certainly don't. But our listeners...
Yeah, you hate the draft. Well, I can't believe you agreed to do this.
No, I mean, I'm curious. Look, we've got to pick. There's a very good chance that between now and you know, the draft itself, Pat Riley decides to package a player on the roster along with his draft pick. Who knows what can happen? A lot can change in between now and then. But if we do wind up taking the draft pick... You know, why not do a little research? You know, we did this with Bam Adebayo the 2017 draft. We didn't suspect Bam Adebayo would be the pick. We were all hoping it would be Donovan Mitchell. Instead, Bam fell on our laps. We hadn't really done research on him. So we're kind of opening our minds a little bit. And so, You know, when it comes to Reddish, he's not likely to be there at 13. Like, I've seen draft boards with Reddish's name all over the place. Anywhere from top five to somewhere in the lower half of the draft. And that's kind of ridiculous considering he was the second overall prospect out of high school. He's another one and done player along with Zion Williamson and RJ Barrett in that incredibly vaunted Duke class that didn't really accomplish anything in their 1 year. But Reddish was even a higher rated prospect out of high school than Williamson was. So that's encouraging. His tangibles, his statistics were pretty solid as far as, you know, his physicality and body type. He's about 6'7", although I've seen some people list him at 6'8". About 210, anywhere from 210 to 215. Not exactly overtly physical or muscular, but he's got really good length. He's got good range. I think he's got about like a 7'1 wingspan is how they recorded it. But again, that'll change between now. These guys are still growing. You know, that's a thing to consider. He's 19 years old, but he's likely to change even a little bit in between now and the combine, etc. So these things can always be updated as the draft gets nearer. But he's an interesting prospect because, again, out of Barrett and Williamson at the Duke level, Reddish was kind of deferred a little bit. So he wasn't exactly the player that a lot of people expect him to be. He wasn't really taking his shot as often as he possibly could, and that's one of the weaknesses against him. But as far as the pros are concerned, overall his defense is pretty solid. He's not, again, the most overtly physical, but he is... got good range. He moves well laterally. He's got the kind of width and quick hands to disrupt passes and things of that sort. So he's got some nice rangy ability on defense. He can block shots a little bit, although he's not exactly a rim protector, but that's mostly because he plays the wing and now in the perimeter. As far as the shooting and offense is concerned, he can get to the rim. He's got good handles. He played a point position in high school. So he's got some versatility in that regard. And his you know, getting to the rim wasn't something that he focused on a lot at Duke for whatever reason. Again, that's another knock on him. But he can finish at the rim. He's creative when it comes to his shot making around the basket. But it's his three-point shooting that he's probably best known for, even though even those numbers weren't particularly electric in his 1 year at Duke. You know, he can create off the dribble. He can spot up pretty well. And he, you know, he his range was pretty good as far as a collegiate player is concerned. So, you know, it's interesting to kind of see where he kind of develops as far as the NBA level is concerned, because he has all these abilities, but he never really got a chance to kind of put the total package on display in his 1 year at Duke. As far as player comps are concerned, like that's...
Well, wait, before we move on, before we go on, though, I agree with you. Cam Reddish, he was somebody that a lot of people thought could go in the top four or five of this draft, right?
Yeah.
And a disappointing season at Duke. He's starting to slide down draft boards. Now I've seen him still in the top five, six, or seven. But we saw with Justice Winslow, sometimes guys just slide. And the reason I think, you know, we decided to kick this thing off with Cam Reddish and you decided to go and scout him is because there is, I think, potential of all these guys who are sort of in that mix for the five or, in the top five or six. He probably has the most potential to drop.
That's
just
what it
based
looks
like on, you know, yeah, just he didn't have a great season at Duke. And I think he was really hurt by not playing. Zion is unbelievable. Cam Reddish, when he gets drafted, probably won't be playing with anybody as good as Zion Williamson, right? Depending on the team that he gets drafted to. I mean, not, you
That's
know,
fair.
Zion's not going to be the best player in the league right away, but he is just this.
Potentially.
This guy who, he's a black hole of basketball. I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just everything, all the attention goes to him. Everything just funnels through Zion. And I think Cam Reddish, he could have been the beneficiary of that. But then you also add the fact that R.J. Barrett was on that roster, and R.J. Barrett is not a clean fit next to Zion. So it was a lot of sort of your turn, my turn stuff happening at Duke. And so Cam Reddish is just sort of this third person that's just, all right, I guess I'll just try to pick and pop where I can and do whatever I can. I actually think of all the guys, well, I shouldn't say that. I think all three of those Duke guys will end up playing better in the NBA if and when they end up in a situation that's sort of tailor-made for them.
Mm-hmm.
But and Cam Reddish certainly is that. I think Cam Reddish, like, people still think R.J. Barrett's good. People obviously think the world of Zion. But I think Cam Reddish could really benefit. He's probably the most complete offensive player of those three, right? You mentioned the outside jumper. He's probably got the smoothest just jump form.
Yeah.
He's probably the only guy who can consistently score at all three levels, at the rim, mid-range, and from three-point range. Of those three again. So I really like Cam Reddish, but there are definitely some red flags too. Wasn't aggressive. You know, the shot was a little, you know, it comes and goes, right?
Yeah. And look, I mean, it's not exactly lighting it on fire at the level, you know, at collegiate level. You know, he only shot 33% from three-point range. You know, it's not great. 36% overall. I mean, most of his shots were from beyond the arc. But either way, it's just... It's hard to kind of play off there. And the knock being that, you know, he deferred to guys like Zion. It's like, I don't know that we've ever seen a quote-unquote super team at the collegiate level like this. Like, it's hard, especially at 18, 19, maybe even 20, trying to balance looking for your shot, but kind of deferring a little bit and taking a back step. Because
we saw mature guy people like LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, and Chris Bosh.
Struggle.
It took a whole year for them just to gel.
Right. And these are guys that were already, you know, in Wade's case, a championship level player, all-stars for multiple seasons. I mean, that's difficult. So, you know, it's kind of interesting to see how Reddish projects at the NBA level, because the comparisons with him are all over the board.
Yeah.
I kind of like the Justice one a little bit because there are the ball handling abilities, the size is there. You know, maybe it's a little too easy because of Duke, although I don't think their styles of play are very similar. I think Reddish is a more natural shooter than Justice is, which is encouraging. Although, if, you know, Heat fans remember correctly, Justice shot pretty well at the you know, collegiate level too, but it's not quite the same thing. I think Reddish is a more natural shooter and a ball handler, and he's capable of doing more offensively, I think, at this point. Although his defense projects to be pretty good. As far as other player comps, I've seen Paul George. That seems probably on the higher end, so don't expect Reddish to turn into a Paul George level player right away. I've also seen J.R. Smith. I've seen Chris Middleton. I think personally he's got the physical type of like a Rodney Hood, a guy who can shoot, who can put it all together and rarely does.
Mm.
So it's kind of hard. Look, he's basically a very long, stretchy wing player with great physical tools and gifts. It's just, you know, I'm curious to see how it all, you know, comes together at the NBA level.
Is it Is it a best case scenario, Paul George, worst case scenario, kind of Rodney Hood type?
I mean, that, even that's not bad. A guy who can play, who can shoot. I mean, Rodney Hood, he's
a good
offensive
player. He's a good bench player.
Right.
Yeah.
Not everybody can turn into a superstar. And I think that's I've seen Joe Johnson too. That seems a little bit extreme. And look, I like the Middleton comp because, again, that's another guy who was long rangey, not a lot of expectations coming out of, what was it, Texas A&M? You know, not a guy that shot off everybody's draft boards there, but he kind of, and he was kind of toiling away in mediocrity for a long time. I mean, a lot of people forget that because now he's like this super underrated player and he finally became an all-star. But, you know, it took some time for him to get to this point. It took a lot of off-court work sessions with Giannis Antetokounmpo in order to kind of figure out his role and things of that sort. But, you know, if Reddish becomes a Chris Middleton player, that's pretty good. And I mean, certainly
it's an all-star. Yeah, he was an all-star.
Absolutely.
And it seems like the common threat, if he's going to, you know, Paul George is all NBA type defense. Chris Middleton is an above average defender. And then Rodney Hood is a negative defensively. So that might be, you know, Cam Reddish, he's got all the scoring ability. The production obviously was not there in college for a number of reasons, partly on him, partly just the situation. But if we expect his just the raw ability then, I guess, to translate to the NBA level, then it's really the work he puts in defensively that could really make the difference for him. Is that kind of where we're going with this?
I think so. I think that's a big part of it, is that his defense needs to be at an elite level in order for him to get, you know, significant playing time. And that'll open things up. I think the offense could probably take another step there. And obviously it'll be fine-tuned at the NBA level. But I think the defense is what's going to get him any kind of significant playing time. So we wanted to break it down into, you know, specific categories about whether or not these players had a chance of immediately contributing, whether or not they could potentially be an all-star or, you know, best case scenario, maybe even a superstar someday. And in Reddish's case, I think percentage-wise, if I had to give one for next season, I'd say it's 30% just because of the roster and the way it's currently, you know, filling out. I don't know that he could come into this raw. Even as good as he is offensively, that's still a raw product. It'll be his defense. Go ahead.
Well, let's give this thing a name. Let's call this the upside scale. Do we like that?
The upside scale. I like it.
The upside scale. Let's talk about his, like, you know, let's look out distant future, 5, 6, 7 years from now, when Cam Reddish is hitting his prime. What is that? Is that what percent do you give that as? All right, he is going to be just a bust. You know, there's a chance he could just be a bust, which I think in this case we could define as low level contributor, not a high level contributor. Maybe some guy who comes off the bench. If you draft Cam Reddish in the top 7 and he turns out to be Rodney Hood, that's probably a bust at that situation.
I don't think so. I disagree with
that. Bust. I know you don't like the word bust in general, but okay. So what would you consider a bust then? If you take this guy
out of the league in three years and kind of falling apart and never really finding any kind of playing time,
Out of the league.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's like
10th, 11th, kind of Michael Beasley type career.
Even that I wouldn't say is a bust. Like, you mean he had solid years, but he had off the court problems, I think, which is why Beasley's reputation is what it is. And, you know, he's never turned into a great NBA player, but he's a hell of a scorer. And I think
so let's define bust then as at the end of a roster or out of the league.
Okay.
Right.
That's fair.
Okay.
And I don't think
contributor.
Yeah.
Is, you know, rotation guy.
Yeah, top 9, 10 guy in the
run. Yeah, exactly. Starter, top 8 or 9 guy, yeah. Then there's All-Star, which is just,
pretty clear.
Makes a couple, one or two All-Star games, that's it. Superstar, top level, top 10 guy in the league, okay?
Yeah, because I don't even know that, Paul George might be there, but even then, I don't know that that's necessarily a case. Like, great defensive player, had some good
Paul George?
Yeah. You think he's a superstar?
Paul George we can consider a superstar. Yeah. We gotta try to figure out some black and white categories here.
Chris Middleton? Is he a superstar?
Is not. Is an all-star.
Okay, good.
So Chris Middleton would be your all-star level. Paul George would be your superstar. Like top 15 guy in the league is a superstar, I guess.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I'd say Paul George is probably anywhere between the eighth and 11th best guy in the NBA, depending on who you're asking. That's a really good player. So percent chance, let's start with the low end. Percent chance that he's a bust.
I'd say 0%, to be honest with you. I think there's enough tools there, and
yeah,
the intangibles have never been a problem. Again, I think it's just a byproduct of the system at Duke and the expectations for that team that we're kind of looking at him and his game a little bit more closely and scrutinizing it, I think, somewhat unfairly. I don't think he'll be a bust. I think he's got the...
So a contributor then.
I think he'll be a likely contributor. Again, I think he'll be, as far as next year, I think there's a good chance, at least 30% that he'll contribute. And by the following season, I expect that to be as high as 90%.
All-star.
50% chance.
You think there's a 50% chance he'll be an all-star?
At some point in his career, yeah. I think that's fair.
And then, yeah, superstar.
0%.
I mean, that would be, well, now, I don't know. Should we make this all add up to 100%? Because then you have 20% left.
Oh,
so it's the first time we're doing Blue Notebook Monday, people. Work with us. Yeah, because you're at 80% now. I don't know. I don't know how this has to add up to 100, right?
Okay, then I'll up his chances of contributing to 40% and put his superstar options at 10%.
10%. That's pretty good, though. But look, this is a guy who, what'd you say, he's the second best prospect coming out of high school? That's fair.
Yeah.
10% chance of becoming a superstar?
Yeah.
Seems about right. Yeah, with all of his tools, I think that's great. Fit with the Heat. If he were to drop to 13, do you think the Heat should grab him?
That's a tough one.
Would he be a good fit for Miami?
That's a tough one to answer, because I think they'd be in love with his, you know, his experience at Duke and playing for Coach Krzyzewski. I think they'd like his defense. I think Justice has enough of a connection with his alma mater, and Shane Battier as well. I mean, there's so many Duke connections throughout the Heat organization, where they probably know a guy like Reddish inside and out. They'd have inside information regarding his work ethic and things of that sort. And, you know, you talk about his lack of aggression. He wouldn't need to be aggressive necessarily in Miami in his first year. And the expectation would be that he'd probably learn enough of quote-unquote Heat culture and kind of fine-tune his body a little bit, maybe get a little bit more leaner, put on some muscle as well, embrace the changing of your body at Miami and to Miami's level and standard. And the problem, as I see it, is that I'm not quite sure what his fit would be as far as this roster is concerned. You've got guys like Derrick Jones Jr. You've got James Johnson. You got Josh Richardson playing, you know, ostensibly as a forward at some point. So where does he get any kind of significant playing time? Are you going to have him leapfrog Duncan Robinson in the rotation? Yeah, I mean, I guess you could make that argument, but at the same time, you want him to be able to play at a high level, and he needs an opportunity. He needs a chance to be able to highlight whatever he can do. Do they stash him at Sioux Falls? That seems like it would be kind of contrary to his development, to be honest with you, especially being a lottery pick. So it's tough to perceive from my perspective how he would fit in Miami. I'd say it'd be a solid fit. Probably not the best one overall for Reddish or for Miami. I think they're still looking for somebody that's probably projected to be more of a four, but can, you know, defend multiple positions. And to Reddish's credit, he could be that guy. He's 6'8", kind of slight, kind of lean. 6'7", rather. I mean, again, I've seen 6'8", 6'7", let's say.
7'1 wingspan.
7'1 wingspan. So he has guarded 1-4, again, at Duke. But, you know, can he do that at the NBA level? I mean, he'd have to put on some weight, I think. And if that's the case,
yeah,
he could be a great player. I just don't know if Miami is the place for him. I think he needs more of an opportunity that he did not have at the collegiate level.
It's not a perfect fit, but if Cam Reddish is sitting there at 13, he's most likely the best player available. And so that becomes a situation where you just say, all right, he's the best guy. Let's just grab him. Okay. My prospect was Kevin Porter Jr. out of USC, a very polarizing player. I've seen him projected top 8 and projected, you know, somewhere in the 20s. We're going to talk about that next. You're listening to Locked on Heat. We want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. Hiring is a challenging thing for businesses to do, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart, a place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/lockedon. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/lockedon. That's ZipRecruiter.com/lockedon. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. David, should we just be using ZipRecruiter for the draft?
Absolutely. I mean, think about it. The draft is such a crapshoot. You never know what you're going to get. We put all our faith in guys that scout college players all over the place, and yet, at the same time, you're never quite sure what kind of a player you're going to get. I know there's a lot to work into that, but at the same time, think of ZipRecruiter as almost 100% likely to get a superstar every time. You use ZipRecruiter, and you will find the best quality candidate, the best quality prospect every time. You can't go wrong with ZipRecruiter.
Yeah, 100. You're giving them 100%. The ad copy here says 80%, but even 80% in the NBA draft would be killer. Yeah. Like, I think teams would kill for the only team that hits 80% in the draft was probably the San Antonio Spurs. They might be using ZipRecruiter. RC Buford in that gang?
Yes. Who knows?
Maybe that's our secret. Okay, ZipRecruiter, smartest way to hire. All right, David. My prospect that I picked was Kevin Porter Jr., shooting guard out of USC, freshman shooting guard. You know, he's got the potential to be a productive scorer. Didn't really show that in his one season at USC. He's 19 years old, 6'6", 218 pounds. He's got a 6'9" wingspan. And in his 1 year at USC, averaged 9.5 points per game, 4 rebounds, 1.4 assists. Had a true shooting percentage of almost 56%. And then shot pretty well from three-point range. Shot 41% on 3.2 attempts per game. And that's really where the pros with Kevin Porter Jr. start. He is a willing shooter. He can create his own shot. He was productive from three-point range, even if he wasn't overall productive across, you know, all aspects of his game. You look at his shot, nice arc, good spin on the ball, consistent form. Little bit of a wonky jump shot form in general, though. He's got this low release point that kind of weighs a little bit to the right side of his body. You know, when you're looking at that from a prospect, you wonder, okay, is he going to be the one of these guys who gets his shot blocked a lot, stuff like that? Do we want to work on that? Do we want to maybe just leave it alone and not mess with it, considering he did shoot over 41% from three-point range? I'd probably lean more towards the latter, just leave it. And really? If you need to correct it at some other point, I would correct it at some other point. Yeah, I mean, he's a good shooter. I'm not, and everybody, nobody's going to have a Klay Thompson jump shot. Not everybody's going to have a Klay Thompson jump shot.
I mean, so I just okay. think
it's
of,
not,
I just
it's
think
not of, like Lonzo Ball weird.
No, I know, but I just think of Richardson. He kind of had a hitch in his shooting motion in college, and they kind of just, you know, wrapped his way through it and kind of worked his way around. And you know, he's got a pretty smooth shot now, obviously. I just think, you know, Richardson had the benefit of 4 years in college, and if a guy like Porter does not stay, obviously he's not likely to stay at the collegiate level. Maybe it's better for him to kind of improve that shot form sooner rather than later, before it's too late.
I don't know. I just, with Josh, it was sort of a situation where he wasn't a very productive perimeter shooter at Tennessee.
No, you're right.
I don't know. But look, that's up to the coaches. That's where he's at right now. He can shoot a little bit off the bounce. He's not afraid to dribble once, dribble twice, do the little side dribble and pull up. Not afraid to do that, and he's pretty productive doing so. And then as far as when he puts the ball on the floor, gets to the basket, he can do it. He's got impressive body control when finishing through contact. He doesn't shy away necessarily from contact in the way that Josh Richardson does, or even Justice Winslow has repeatedly done over the last season. So that's good. And physically, he's able to do that. Again, 6'6", 218. He's got physically, he's NBA ready. And that's one of the things that people like the most out of Kevin Porter Jr.
Why did you choose Porter, considering where he is on some mock drafts? Because I've seen him like a second round pick. And do you think he is likely to kind of jump up the draft based on preseason workouts?
I think so. I think because of all of the, you know, you're going to put him in a gym. You're going to put him in a gym and he is going to jump out of that gym. I mean, we're not talking about like Russell Westbrook at a UCLA athlete, but mm-hmm. He's a great athlete. Physically, he looks the part. He'll be able to do all the things. He'll be able to dribble around the right chairs the right way and make a bunch of jumpers in a row. Like, he'll be able to do all that stuff that in the pre-draft process tend to help guys rise on draft boards. So, and then look, I think when you talk about his cons, I think there's certain things that he'll be able to prepare for. The major one is that he only played 21 games due to injuries, and then he was indefinitely suspended for conduct issues, what they deemed conduct detrimental to the team. And it was never really clear what exactly happened there, but there are maturity issues with him. But you could sort of prepare for your interviews, prepare your answers, and do those things, and maybe, and just be, hey, you know, this guy is figuring it out. You know, maybe he could fool a few teams, or I don't know. I don't. We don't really know what happened there. So the reason I picked him was because he is so polarizing, and I just thought it would be a great way to start, because there's a good chance he's on the board for Miami. And he's such a high-risk, high-reward type of guy that if you're the Heat and you're trying to find a superstar, we'll get there later, but he has superstar potential, right? And so I thought this would just be an interesting kind of guy to dig into a little bit here. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, isn't he, if he is... And there are as many questions as there are about this guy, particularly because of his off-court stuff. Isn't this a possibility where you could potentially like trade down in the draft, maybe move a player? You know, if you've got the 13th pick and this guy is your guy and you want to select him, would it be, do you think it's advisable to kind of just trade down, maybe move the 13th pick in Deion for like...
I've seen him mocked for top seven. I mean, he might not be there when the Heat pick. I don't think he's, depending on how this draft process works out for him, he's the kind of guy where, look, the Heat are going to do their due diligence. They should have some feelers out there and figure out where he would go if they don't pick him, if he's indeed on the board when they are selecting. Mm-hmm. So maybe it does become a situation when they're, but we've rarely seen the Heat trade down. Trading down is not really a thing that happens a lot in the NBA. If the Heat pass on him and then he's taken later and you sort of just do a swap, I can maybe see that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But even so, that's still sort of working that out beforehand. And so maybe that's a situation, but 13 seems about, like, if the draft were to happen today and the Heat took Kevin Porter Jr. at 13, I don't think people would say that that was a reach. Mm. I think people would say the Heat are comfortable knowing that this is a risk, but they are willing to bet on Kevin Porter Jr. And that's what we're trying to figure out right now. Are you willing to bet on Kevin Porter Jr.? Some of the things that do... Some of the minuses in his game, more potential than proof defensively, right? We talked about the 6'9 wingspan. Physically, he looks the part. He has all the tools to be a good NBA defender. Wasn't necessarily a great defender at USC. He did have a positive box, a defensive box plus minus, but that's just in college. That's usually just if you're one of the most talented guys on the team, you tend to just have that.
Right.
So you'd like to see a little bit more there. He did average almost 4 fouls per 40 minutes. So he tends to reach a little bit, get a little bit more aggressive. You'd like to just see those. You'd like to see you'd like to just see him be a little bit more, stout defensively, not reaching in so much. Just kind of dotting his I's and crossing his T's on that end. And then we talked about his shot-making ability. He's very confident in his shot-making ability, but that does lead to some questionable shot selection.
Right.
There's a little irrational confidence thing happening there. He will pull up from long twos. He'll dribble into three-pointers that he doesn't necessarily need to. He'll take contested shots that he doesn't necessarily have to take, and he'll often just do that in lieu of making the right pass. And the right pass might be very obvious, but he'll just take the shot anyway. So you want a guy who can make tough shots. We've seen how important in these playoffs, how important that could be. But you don't want this guy only taking tough shots, which has submarined a lot of careers. And then as far as the pass making, he's a shoot-first kind of guy, not a natural passer. Averaged more turnovers at 1.9 than assists in college at 1.4. So overall, I think there's going to be a really steep learning curve for Kevin Porter Jr. when he comes out. He has the potential immediately, I think, David, to jump in and come off the bench and just be like a scorer for 15 minutes a game where you put him in when you need to juice your offense a little bit. But if he's going to be the lead guard, which he was projected to be coming out of high school, a lead guard on an elite offense, his passing, his maturity level, his feel for the game, I think, on a passing and a facilitating level, needs to get a lot better than where it is now. And so I do think he's a couple of years away from really getting into a lead guard playmaker type of role.
A lot of that sounds like there's way too many question marks there that I think would turn off Miami. They're not the kind of organization thinking about where they you know, where they like to select players, what the kind of players that they'd like to choose for their organization, it doesn't seem like they would go a Kevin Porter Jr. route. There's talent there, but I question whether or not he'd be a good fit in Miami. Is there a player comp that you feel comfortable making to a guy like Kevin Porter? Because yeah, at 6'6", I mean,
you're going to hate these.
Go for it.
You're going to hate these player comps. So the first one that came to mind was Deion Waiters, and you watch him, and there is that ability. You know how Deion has this ability to just sort of get to the rim?
Sure.
He's not De'Aaron Fox. He's not just blazing a trail towards the basket. He's not necessarily Dwayne Wade, just sort of doing this herky-jerky, getting his, you know, making his way, you know, a DeMar DeRozan type. But he's somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. There is a natural athleticism. To me, that's sort of Kevin Porter Jr. I don't doubt his ability to get to the rim. It's what he does when he gets there that I have questions about. Other player comps, J.R. Smith.
Oof.
And really aggressive Jeremy Lamb.
Wow.
Like if Jeremy Lamb was angry or had like a bunch of espresso shots before
instead of sleepy all the time.
Instead of sleepy. Like Jeremy Lamb with espresso. That's kind of where I'm at. But look, if I'm going to go high upside, and I'm talking about, okay, if we were going to compare him to a superstar, the closest comp I can find is James Harden. Because, and I'm not saying he's going to be James Harden, but that's sort of best case scenario for Kevin Porter Jr. If he keeps adding to his game every year, maturing every year, getting a little bit better at the facilitating and the playmaking thing, he has an ability to make tough shots that few players in this draft have. And that is the thing there's so many question marks with him, but I keep going back to this. He can make a tough shot, and that is such an important thing in today's game, and something that the Heat don't really have. Like, Josh Richardson has made them, but I wouldn't qualify Josh Richardson as a tough shot maker, you know? He's more of a beneficiary of good offense. This guy can just create offense by himself, and he could do it at a pretty efficient clip if the decision-making gets a little bit better. Like, all the raw ability is right there. He even showed a few step-back threes in college. He's creative with the ball in a way that nobody else on the Heat is, as far as, you know, putting the ball on the ground and pulling up and finding a shot that makes sense and works for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, that stuff is so important that you kind of want to gloss over all these other negatives because he could just do that so well. And whatever team takes Kevin Porter Jr., Heat or otherwise, they are going to do that. They are going to say, I know all this bad stuff with him, but man, he does this really well, and I don't know that anybody else in the draft that's going to be available outside the top five can do it as well as this guy. And so you could really hit on Kevin Porter Jr. if it works out, and if the coaching is good. He is going to need good coaching, and so, well, we'll get to there. But as far as the comparisons, that's where I'm at. Upside scale. For a bust, you had Cam Reddish at 0%, right?
Yes.
I've got Kevin Porter 30%. There is a 30% chance he is out of the league in 3 or 4 years.
I could see that.
Yeah. Again, maturity issues. We don't really know what's going on there. We've seen guys who can, you know, theoretically score, just not pan out. We've seen that 100 times.
Michael Beasley. He could be.
There we go. Contributor, I think about 50%, where he's one of your, you know, Jeremy Lamb, J.R. Smith, contributors. You know, one of the top 8 guys on your roster, does some stuff. If he's hot one night, you play him a little bit longer. That's kind of, you know, I could see that absolutely working out. More likely than not, that's kind of where he ends up. All-star, 17%.
17, very specific.
17%, he's an all-star, yeah. And I've got 3%, he's a superstar. But man, if you can get a guy at 13, and we don't think Cam Reddish, we had at 10%, or you had at 10%, we don't think he's necessarily even going to be there when the Heat pick at 13.
Right.
If you can get a guy at 13 where there's a 20% chance that he is an all-star or better, but then there's like an 80% chance that he's really not that good.
Right.
That's really like, that's what we're talking about, right? Like there's a 30% chance that he's a bust, a 20% chance that he ends up making an all-star team. That is the definition of high risk, high reward. And that it just sort of, it comes down to the organization.
Right.
Is that the sort of player you want to take? We saw that the Heat with Bam Adebayo took a high floor guy with Bam. Kevin Porter Jr. is not a high floor guy. He's got one of the lowest floors in the draft right now. So, my projection is that he will be there when the Heat are picking. I do think he'll end up being there. And I do think it's a fit for Miami if they are committed to rebuilding around the young guys. If they are committed to saying, let's take this guy. We've got young guys with high floors. Winslow, Richardson, Bam Adebayo. We know that those three guys are going to be contributors at the very least, potentially all-stars. Two or three of them potentially all-stars. Maybe we swing for the fences here and try to get the final piece of that young core. You know what I mean?
No, I can understand the argument. At the same time, I think given the position that Richardson plays, given the fact that Justice projects to be a point guard and that's probably where he's best used, I just don't see how a guy like Porter Jr. gets significant playing time in order to develop. And then you're talking about either moving Richardson up or, you know, stunting Porter's development. And so I think it complicates things as you're looking at him being a fit on this roster. I think the off-the-court issues are going to scare this franchise completely away. And then you're also looking at just overall fit, not just for the young guys, but on this roster period. You just kind of, you know, helped release some of that logjam last season by trading away Tyler Johnson and Wayne Ellington. I don't know how you select another guard, however great his potential might be, to add to that, particularly when you've already got a guy like Dion Waiters, who may not necessarily be the best influence on somebody who plays a lot like Dion Waiters. So, I mean, you know,
you're going to need somebody to replace Dwayne Wade's minutes, right? I think Kevin Porter Jr. works there. I do think that there's room for another guard with Dwayne Wade retiring. I think there's another room for a guard on the roster, especially if they look to move Dion Waiters. Mm-hmm. And if you draft Kevin Porter Jr., maybe that's what you're really, you get a little aggressive about doing that, and you maybe even throw in some future assets or something to move off of Dion's contract. I don't know. Maybe you just get a little bit more aggressive in that regard. But I think with Kevin, I actually like the fit. I thought about it a lot. Let's keep in mind, this guy could be really switchy on defense. 6'9" wingspan. He's got a great frame that he could grow into.
Marcus Smart-like.
If you put, but like taller.
Right.
And so,
I mean, I'm
like J.R. Smith was a good defender for 2 years. You know what I mean?
I seem to recall that being a case at some point. But I mean, like, as far as the Marcus Smart comparison, like, he's sturdy enough. Like Dion, you know, but he's a little taller than both of those
sturdy
players.
Exactly. Exactly. And he's taller. He's a little bit rangier. Like, you could put Winslow, Kevin Porter Jr., and Josh Richardson as your backcourt. You know, whatever. And those guys could switch everything. Those guys could switch everything. And you throw James Johnson or Derek Jones Jr. in there with Bam Adebayo at center. Those guys could switch everything. Like, defensively, that unit could be a beast. And I love the fit defensively. Offensively, there are questions. But like I said, Kevin Porter Jr. can't have the ball in his hands all the time. He is a bad decision maker right now. Justice Winslow is a great decision maker. You put the ball in Justice's hands. There is a little overlap between Kevin Porter Jr. and Josh Richardson. There will have to be a little bit of you turn, my turn. But if you really do want to bet on Kevin Porter Jr.'s star potential, then you just say, okay, we're going to live with this for a year or two. We'll let them figure it out. And if, look, we have to move one or two of these guys, and we do it. But, you know, I'm not arguing for Kevin Porter Jr. I'm just saying that's where the mindset would have to be if the Heat were to take him, is to say, like, look, we actually like the fit next to Justice Winslow. We want the ball in Justice's and Josh's hands more often. We don't have to – that mitigates Kevin Porter Jr.'s decision-making liability, and we can really just lean into his shot-making ability.
So there are questions there, and again, as you pointed out, Miami will have done their homework, like most teams in the league, I think, but you can trust Miami to be a little bit more thorough in that process, and I just don't know that even at 13, if he was available there, that they'd make that their selection. If you had to give a percentage just of whether or not Miami would take their pick, assuming that they've done the research and that he checks out okay as far as whatever off-court and psychological issues, and I hate using the term psychological, but I couldn't think of anything else right away, you know, do you think he has the kind of ability that Miami would say, you know what, at 13, let's take him? If you had to give a percentage to whether or not they choose him, what would that be?
I'm trying to eliminate my own bias because I'm a swing for the fences kind of guy, especially at this point where the Heat have no other realistic routes to go get a superstar this soon, right? To go get a future superstar.
3%
chance,
baby.
The quickest way to do that is through the draft. I would say it's about, I would probably put it, if he's on the board, I'd probably say there's a 30 or 40% chance they take him. I'll go 40% chance they take him.
Wow.
If he's on the board.
That's pretty
me
high.
Personally, my bias, I want to say 50-50. Again, it really depends. There's so much of this depends on what they think about him when they sit down and talk to him and talk to the people around him. So much of that depends. But if you're a 13, man, and there are no plans to be in the top five anytime soon, and you've already got your unprotected pick in 2021 moving to another team, I think this is the time, especially when you have three high-floor young guys. You don't really need another young player like that. You need to take a chance here. And Kevin Porter Jr. might be the best chance worth taking at 13. I kind of am talking myself into it a little bit, but we're going to be doing so many more of these over the next few weeks that I'm sure I'm going to talk myself into a bunch of other guys too. So Cam Reddish, Kevin Porter Jr., we've done the scouting reports on them. We'll have two more players to do next week. That's it for our scouting reports. We'll be back with another pair of players yet to be decided. We'll figure that out after we're done recording here. But we're adding a new wrinkle to our Monday shows. David, I thought it would be fun to do some Game of Thrones talk. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea, obviously. For anybody who is listening to this right now, if you haven't seen the latest episode, if you're not caught up, sorry. Thank you so much for listening up to this point. Please catch up with us at some other point once you do catch up with the show. At the same time, look, that show, The Long Night, fantastic episode. I've seen so many people arguing about it one way or the other. I think if you didn't like the show or you didn't like that particular episode, I'm not quite sure what you're looking for out of this show. It's not a particularly realistic. It's not a crime drama. If you're looking for that, that's not the option for you. But at the same time, I've seen people criticize how it worked out. But man, that was as a great example of pacing in an hour and a half of that show, maybe a little bit less than an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It started off slowly, but it was palpable. The tension as they're preparing for what could be the longest night of their lives, where they're looking ahead and they're saying, you know what? There's a very, very, very little chance that we're going to survive this event. And so you could feel that tension. And I love that sensation. And then once the battle actually began, it was nonstop. I mean, there were a few breaks here and there just because, you know, you don't want to cause a heart attack somewhere. But at the same time, it was just really, really, you know, neck-breaking speed. And it was just incredible how much activity was going on. And well, I think they did a really good job of tying all the different stories and main characters together so you could see where they were throughout the episode.
Well, let's take a quick break here and then we'll get into some of the specifics on the episode. I agree. It was an awesome, phenomenal episode. But quick break. You're listening to Locked On Heat. Remember to get this show every day by subscribing to Locked On Heat on the new Himalaya podcast app. In an ever-expanding podcast world, you need Himalaya. With their personal curated playlists and new features, download Himalaya at your app store and subscribe to Locked On Heat. All right, David, Game of Thrones talk. Before we go on, spoiler alert, if you're not caught up on Game of Thrones, we're not talking about basketball anymore in this show, so you can just end the podcast here, and just we'll be back tomorrow with our Josh Richardson exit interview, so have a great night. Thank you very much for listening. If you're down to talk some Thrones, we're doing it now. First of all, David, hell of a 24 hours for Arya Stark.
That was an unforeseen twist. Like, I mean, I know a lot of people can look back and with the gift of hindsight say, oh yeah, I saw it coming. But at the same
time, I saw it coming. Can I just tell you? David, I saw it coming. I told my girlfriend 2 days before. I was like, lies. You know who I think does it?
Lies.
No, it's not a lie. Arya Stark.
Lies.
Look, she was training.
You're standing for Sansa to somehow kill the Night King. I don't know how.
No, Sansa's my favorite character besides Ramsay. But besides Ramsay Bolton. But Arya, her entire character arc was building up to this moment. She was the only one capable of doing this. That was my argument. When I made the prediction 2 days ago, I said, you know, the Night King kind of just knows everything that's going on. Arya is a trained silent assassin. Mm-hmm. Jon Snow is like, he's like brooding and kind of emo, but he's not necessarily, you know, he's not silent.
He's not slick either.
Whether he's on a dragon or he's dragging a giant sword behind him. Like, he kind of makes things into scenes. Arya Stark is just one stab done. She's in and out, pokey end. Go. Like, I thought it made a lot of sense. I was stoked to see that Arya Stark was the one that did it, because it would have been a little too cliche if Jon Snow had done it.
It felt like that could have been, you know, the way it worked out, to be honest with you. I didn't see that was a problem. I mean, the way they set it up with Jon kind of chasing after the Night King, you thought there was going to be some kind of epic swords battle, and that would have worked out pretty well given what the show has been throughout the 8 seasons of it. But at the same time, I think that was a nice twist. Right as the tension is building, the Night King standing in front of Bram and kind of just like looks at him a little bit. You see like him registering something. Who knows what the Night King's thinking? But at the same time, he's just kind of bemused there. He reaches back for his sword, and out of nowhere, I love that little part there where one of the Night King's henchmen or council or whatever they're called, the Council of Popoviches, you know, you kind of see a little breeze there. And it kind of blows that ancient white hair, and then you kind of suspect that something's going to happen, and he looks over like, but no, there's nothing there because, and we're talking about a freaking ninja in Arya Stark. And right as the Night King's about to stab down on Bram, out of nowhere, out of the darkness, she just leaps, I guess, hiding in the trees. Who knows where she was?
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing. I love the shot, too, because it's just, you kind of see it from over the Night King's shoulder. And there, all of a sudden, he's reaching back. And then all of a sudden, Arya just comes from out of nowhere with that little dagger in her hand. I mean, that was amazing. And then, of course, then the Night King catches her with one hand. Doesn't reach for his sword, catches Arya by the neck instead. And then Arya pulls off arguably the baddest ass move of all time. Drops the dagger, picks it up with her other hand, and then stabby stabby from that point forward. That was amazing.
It was the Jordan switch hands mid layup. I mean, it was perfect. And she knew, she had it done. And look, I didn't think she was making it out of the library alive necessarily.
No.
Like, there were questions about, because the entire, this was the third episode of the season, all the second episode was basically setting it up like, okay,
who's gonna
say
die?
Goodbye to all of these guys, yeah. Because they could all be dead within a week. And so you just didn't know, like, you knew people were going to die, you just didn't know how many and who exactly.
And some people are still gonna die, whoever survives the long night.
By the way, poor Ed. Can we just like shout out to Ed? Yeah. I'm sitting there on the couch, and who died? It was Ed, and then
Jorah Mormont.
It was Jorah, and then there was one other person, right? It was three. The little girl. What's her face?
Lyanna Mormont.
Lyanna Mormont.
House Mormont. So we lost two Mormonts. Yeah, they're gone.
We lost two Mormonts. All of the Dothraki and Theon and
Theon. How could we forget Theon? Yeah.
And Ed. So we're sitting there on the couch watching it, and then Lyanna, I think, was the second person to die with the giant. And you know, my girlfriend goes, "Oh, first person to die was Lyanna." I was like, "Did you just forget about Ed, who died in like the first 5 minutes? We just killed off Ed. Everybody forgot about Ed. Ed walks onto the screen, you're like, who's that guy again?"
Everybody forgets about Ed. I'll be honest with you, I didn't even remember his name until later on.
It's Ed. Okay. Everybody's got crazy names. He's Ed.
Ed, yeah, I know. It's probably short for what, Edison or something like that. But anyway, I want to talk a little bit about Bram a little bit, because I texted you last night. Do you think he foresaw that this was coming, and that's why he gave the dagger to Arya back in season 7?
Oh, I think he. I'm really confused about what his deal is in general. Does he see the future? Because we know he sees the past. Like it's what's he say? It's written in ink or whatever. Mm-hmm. He sees the past. We know that he sees all of it. I think that there are scenarios that he just sees all the different scenarios. And so when the Night King walks in, and it's basically the Night King and Bran sitting there and Theon in the middle of them, right. That's when Bran kind of looks at Theon and he goes, "You're a good man, thank you." Because at that point he knows, all right, there are several different, well, they set him up, but there was several different scenarios. Like maybe the Night King wouldn't have gotten that far if Jon and Dany's plan had worked and they were just going to burn him before he walked in.
So you think maybe he set up Theon by telling him, "Oh, you're a brave man," knowing that Theon would then kind of take a little extra time and charge the Night King, kind of stall things a little bit, waiting until Arya gets into motion.
I think I also just think from an emotion, just a personal level, he was like, "All right, like there was ways where we could have avoided this, but the Night King's standing 10 feet in front of you. You're got, man. Like this is it." So at that point he says, "Thanks," because he knows exactly what's going to play out next, that Theon is going to charge at the Night King because that's what Theon's going to do. So I think he sees several scenarios playing out. I wonder, and I guess the Arya scenario was one, right, that he saw playing out. And that he must have in that moment known, because he didn't seem at all bothered that he was about to get sliced and diced by the Night King, right?
No, he didn't. Like, he kind of seemed like resigned to it. Like, it's like, "Oh, you're going to chop me up? Go ahead." I mean...
Well, I don't think he thought it was going to happen. I thought he knew at that point that Arya was waiting to do her little stab and grab.
Potentially. Do you feel like you were kind of wanting more as far as the background of the Night King and what the nature of him and the three-eyed raven was?
I think we're going to get that. But you're all we know is that he's a bad dude that wants to kill people. Do we think that he is a Targaryen because he wasn't affected by the flames?
No, I don't think that's a problem at all. I don't think that's it at all.
You think it's just his mysticism that he wasn't able to get burnt? Okay, because we know that I thought that might have been a little bit of a nod. Like, we don't really know where the Night King came from. Is he a Targaryen? I think we're gonna get more because there's three episodes to fill now, and it can't just be like
fighting Cersei. You know,
can't be fighting Cersei and her pirate boyfriend. Like, there's got to be a little bit more context, right?
Yeah.
Can't just be like beating up a pregnant lady for three episodes.
Well, what about the comeback of the Red Queen there? I mean, that was pretty impressive. She was, I think she was the MVP of the episode, to be honest with you.
She sort of was, right? There was a few empty jump shots there. It was like a little early garbage time, setting all the swords on fire, and that just didn't really help at all.
It was not her fault. I mean, she gave everybody hope, even for a second. And then she kind of lit the trenches there, which also did not seem to make much of a difference. But without her little pep talk to Arya,
yes,
I think she's the unspoken MVP there. I don't know.
She's like that Udonis Haslam of the. She's Udonis Haslam of the episode where she just threw a water bottle in the locker room and everybody's like, "All right, I guess we'll get up and go now."
That's what it took, huh?
That's a really good call out though, because without her pep talk, because Arya, they end up in this keep in the middle of Winterfell.
Yeah,
it's her, the Hound, and just like
and the remains of
Lady of Fire person, Bear, just Darien, like yeah, she's just like she was standing there. She was like, "I'm good here, guys." they walk in on her little private, you know, meditation session or whatever it is she does, and she was just like, "That's cool that you guys just escaped like a bunch of whites. That's really nice, but you can't just sit here. Like, go do something." Without that, maybe Arya doesn't do what she did. So
yeah, it's kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy there, because she kind of gave Arya the confidence to know that she could do it by having told her all those years ago, "I saw you doing this already." So kind of Arya was like, "Oh, you know what? I'm actually going to pull this off. I know, because it's already been predestined. I know destiny and predestined and your fortune and everything else like that has a lot to do in the books, and I think this the prophecy kind of works out this way as well. So I know that's another question.
So one thing that did bother me about the show.
Go for it.
One thing that did bother me about this episode, I think overall it was an awesome episode, one of the best episodes Game of Thrones ever put together. Really, really happy with it. I'm probably going to watch it again later this week. I am stoked.
Yes.
Arya's awesome. Everything's great. Except this one thing, for the first 30 minutes of this episode, I was screaming at the television because I couldn't figure this out. And maybe you can enlighten me here, David, but give me one good reason why when they retreated, right, and Grey Worm and his army helped frame the retreat, right, and everybody from Winterfell went back into the gates, and Red Lady set the things on fire,
right,
and you've got a bunch of whites standing on the other side of the flames, right, just the thousand of them just standing there, and everybody's just waiting for them. Where the hell was Dany and Jon and their dragons to just burn all those dudes to a crisp instead of just waiting for them to all just flood the gates? Where were they? I was screaming at my television for 30 minutes. You have them all right here. You didn't have any problem burning everybody and everything when it was a whole mingle and mismatch of, you know, humans versus whites. You didn't have a problem just going through and burning people then. Now you've got them all set up right here. It's fish in a barrel. Burn them all.
The Night King's the priority there. Because even if they do burn those corpses.
But Dany was just flying around doing nothing.
She was, well, theoretically, she was stuck in that snowstorm, which is completely unexpected. But remember, the Night King did fight them on his dragon as well. And you take him out, as Arya did, then that kind of changes everything. So I think that was still the priority. It makes sense. I mean, if you can muster all your forces to taking out one adversary as opposed to thousands and thousands of them. Now, it does sacrifice a lot of your troops, including the Unsullied, and of course the whole Dothraki horde, which is no longer existent. That's a sacrifice, I guess, that she was willing to make. I don't know. It's a tough one. I saw some people argue
that. The Dothraki weren't used to snow.
I'm sorry?
No, the Dothraki weren't used to snow. But,
I don't think they were used to thousands of dead people trying to eat their faces.
That's true. True, too. Also true. Not sure which was more disturbing, but...
Yeah, I'll take the cold over a zombie army, I'll be honest with you. I'll go shirtless in sub-zero temperatures rather than having to face an army of the dead.
I really don't like skiing. Who are you going to miss? Okay, wait. I was going to ask you who you're going to miss the most that died, and then we'll look forward to next week and think who lived, who has, you know...
Who has yet to die?
...chance to die. Yeah, like, who's next? But before I ask you that, worst performance, Jon Snow or Dany?
Oh, you see, I don't have a problem with either of what they did, to be honest with you. I know people have been critical of it. If I had to pick one... I guess John was largely inefficient, and whereas at least Dany tried. I mean, she failed maybe, and she kind of, you know, kind of stumbled around a little bit and wasn't really successful in everything she did. But did John do anything? Like, he chased around for the Night King, didn't really do anything, right. And then kind of just fell and
ignored
then,
his buddy Sam.
Yeah, he fell straight to the ground and then kind of chased him, and then he kind of held it off, and then after that, he managed to get into the castle and then kind of be like, "Oh." There's a dead dragon trying to kill me here. And then he just did nothing else. And then it was like him hiding behind rocks for 10 minutes.
Yeah, he's basically playing laser tag while everybody else was trying to get stuff done.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know. It's a tough call, I guess. I mean,
thank goodness for Arya.
Yeah, I think she saved everything. Now, as far as the people who died who I'm going to miss most, clearly not Ed, because I didn't even remember who he was. Theon, moment of redemption. I've seen some people say, you know, it's not like he really redeemed himself completely considering all the things that he did badly throughout the course of his youth. And yeah, that makes sense too. I think it's got to be Jorah Mormont. I mean, he was a noble character. He kind of messed up a little bit there. To see that moment at the end there with Daenerys crying over him and the dragon kind of huddling them up like, don't worry about it. It's going to be okay, sweetie. I kind of dug that. I really liked it. And I think he was happy. Not to have died, obviously, but that he kind of had this other chance after having been cured of his disease by Samuel Tarly to be able to defend the woman he loved with all his heart, to be able to counsel her the way he was, to be able to defend her in any way possible. Like, he died the way he would have wanted to have died most, by being able to ensure that she was safe and healthy, etc. So, I like that.
Do we think that now Dany has... What was the sword that Sam gave Jorah?
Ooh.
I'm blanking on the name right now.
Oh,
the Valyrian steel sword.
Yeah, I can't remember.
Which are very rare, and only really important people have swords of Valyrian steel. Jon has Longclaw, of course. Do we think now that Dany will pick up that sword now that Jorah is dead? You assume that she picks up that sword because she's not like a swordsman by any means, but she understands what's important in this realm and what's not, and I'm sure she sees that this Valyrian steel sword is going to be important. So she picks that up. Let's assume that, I guess.
No, I wouldn't.
Or just lays there in the middle of the snow forever, and it's just like we've got this Valyrian steel sword just out there for nobody.
No,
to
I think
these things always change hands. That's kind of the deal.
Yeah, I think they'll give him a formal burial as opposed to all the rest of the corpses that they'll probably just set on fire, and they'll give him a formal burial with the sword atop, and then Sam will either say something or somebody will be like, oh, hold on, that's not really his sword. And to Sam's credit, he'll probably be like, no, I don't really care. Like, he died defending you with a sword, why not go ahead and keep it?
Okay. That's fair. I kind of am digging this idea that we've already got a little bit of tension, not a little bit, a lot of tension between Dany and John with the whole throne situation and the fact that, you know, they're related.
Sure.
John has a Valyrian steel sword. I'd like to see Dany have one in her pocket for whatever
she can't even lift
in
it.
The future.
Like Sam,
them.
I mean,
I don't know. It's
Sam's
she
not much
have
of a fighter.
Drawer lift it. I don't know.
He couldn't.
I think she's
going
to add it to her toolbox. Is all I'm saying. That's where I'm at.
She's got a dragon, dude.
I'm not going to miss any.
You got a dragon. You got all the toolbox you need when you have two dragons waiting behind you.
Well, he's got a dragon too.
Well, it's kind of a loner. Like, I mean, they're parked in her garage. I think.
I don't know.
She's the mother of dragons. It's like they're not going to like switch family.
He's the father of dragons.
Well, not really.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know how we'll dragons see. Think. All right. I'm not going to miss anybody from this episode except for the Night King and Ed. Shout out to Ed. Who dies next? Really quick before we close out here.
Brienne.
Yeah, I'm with you. Thanks for listening, and remember that you can subscribe to this show on the new Himalaya Podcast app, as well as Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks to ZipRecruiter for sponsoring the show. When you get in your car, tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Heat. Connect with us on Twitter at Locked On Heat or email us at LockedOnHeat@gmail.com. We'll have our Josh Richardson exit interview for you tomorrow. Thanks for spending some time with us today. We'll catch you next time. Thanks for joining me, David.
You got it, Wes.